Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Madhuri Vijay, author of The Far Field, which was published by Grove Atlantic on January 15th. The Far Field is a book of travel, almost in a picaresque manner. The journey of a woman who is an admixture of good and bad qualities we all possess, but with whom we can empathize, and whose mistakes are mistakes we have all made, sometimes with unfortunate or even tragic consequences. Shalini, our protagonist, is privileged and restless, much like the Buddha, who sets out on a journey from her home in cosmopolitan Bangalore, to the mountains of Kashmir, a dangerous Kashmir. She is searching for Bashir Ahmed, a man from her past, who perhaps she loves, and perhaps is just a connection between her and her mother, whose tragedy may be the catalyst for this journey. Throughout the book, Shalini makes lots of choices, some of them with pleasant and kind intention. In fact, she always seems to mean well, but some of those choices lead to violent and tragic conclusions. Some of the people she meets are enemies and some are good friends. Sometimes it's hard to tell the difference. It may very well be that her naivete, which causes her to make the decisions that she does, it may be something that we as the reader have to figure out ourselves. And as I've said many times before, these are the best of books. So with that, welcome, Madhuri, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So how did you come up with your epigraph by Wisława Szymborska from some people, a Polish author, who seems as far away from India as possible?
You know, I no longer remember how I came across this epigraph, or this poem, rather. But the minute I came across it very early, right at the beginning of when I was writing the book. And it seemed to me to be a good pointer. And I had it at the beginning of the document that I was working on. And every day I would open that document and I would look at the poem. And I would sort of steady myself, or, you know, come back to a focused point. And I realized, I debated whether or not to even keep it, because by the end, the book seemed to have outgrown that epigraph. But I had grown so fond of it, and it was so familiar to me that I kept it, I think, for more sentimental reasons than anything else. But it certainly isn't necessary in order to read the book.
But it does foreshadow the book in the sense that it does ask the question, who's enemy and who's friend, and will one person, like, for example, Stalin, let you go or let you have your life or not? So it does.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it also is applicable in quite mundane circumstances. You know, we make choices daily about how to treat our friends and family, and, you know, whether to act or not to act. And, you know, it's a quite a capacious epigraph. It's pretty much applicable to any book, I think.
Yeah, except actually it is, because the relationship between father and mother and daughter here is so complicated. But the follow-up question to that, the epigraph, would be, and I've heard you say this, you know, the first line of the book is really what propelled you, which is, I am 30 years old and that is nothing. Talk a little bit about how, you know, whenever you got stuck, you came back to that line.
Right. That was not the original first line. I had spent about a year writing some version of this novel, which nobody would recognize it as the same book. It had, you know, different narrators and was three different perspectives, and it was going nowhere. It was absolutely dull. I think I was trying to write a safe novel that would be recognizable to readers, And I was failing miserably. And then I think this was at the end of 2012, the beginning of 2013, I was watching the news or something. I was very angry. And all of a sudden this line popped into my head, I am 30 years old and that is nothing. And I liked that line because it is an acknowledgement of your own, one's own ignorance and one's own lack of self-importance. There's something tender about that line, and, you know, I think some people would disagree. You know, they'd say 30 years old is plenty. But in the life of a nation, 30 years is nothing. You know, the conflict in Kashmir has been going on for 30 years. And, you know, many conflicts before that. So it seems 30 years seems to me a strange amount of time. In a human life, it's quite significant. In the life of a nation, it's not. And that interested me.
Yeah, I remember I had a neighbor, Isabel Wicks, and she was old. And I was almost 30, and I said, I'm not really sure I've decided what I want to do with my life.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, if you haven't decided by 30, you probably never will. And it really...
Well, that sounds, it's a nice thing to say. I mean, it sounds fat, but I don't think that's true.
No, it's almost like when Shalini's mother calls her a little beast, because mm-hmm. half of it is with love, and half of it is with a kind of derision. You know, that's how that made me feel, like she was stabbing me with a needle, but she was also giving really good advice.
It's a form of parenting that's recognizable the world over.
Yes. Well, what about Shalini's mother? I mean, she's one of the most complex characters that I've ever read, and a lot of the people who've blurbed or talked about the books feel the same way. And that goes back to the idea of some of the things I talked about in the introduction, about love and the absence of love, and about goodness and a lack of that, or a inability to feel a certain way. How could you possibly have developed somebody, unless you knew somebody like this, who had that admixture of things?
I do know, you know, they're not my parents.
No, I know,
I know people like that. People who seem to be on the verge of exploding, you know, people who are so, whose life is so much unlike what they thought it would be, and yet who are so helpless to change it for one reason or another, that it creates this untenable state of near, you know, near detonation. And she, Shalini's mother, she was really fun to write, as you can imagine.
Oh, yes.
For a few reasons. One, because she just made the scene crackle. And two, because there is, for me, and I think for most people who read a character like that, there's a pleasure in hearing someone say things that are just awful. You know, we tend to be careful in life, and there are things that we would never say that we want to say. And to hear her say absolutely the worst things, like to, you know, tell her guest, her dinner guest, that, you know, she's boring, is there's a kind of a vindictive pleasure in that that I think most people will acknowledge if
and
they're honest.
She goes, that's such a boring story. Let's eat.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you've been in that position. I've been in that position.
I know. And then she goes, oh, what a lovely party.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
And
I think she gets pleasure out of being unpredictable. Yeah.
But then what you throw in that makes it like, that makes her kind of great is when she's leaning out the window with her husband, yelling that her daughter is a champion. And you can feel the idea that, yes, deep down there is this love. And Little Beast is is a pleasant thing to say. It's a pleasant name for somebody.
Yeah, I think anybody who has a complicated parent knows that admixture, as you said, of love and scorn and all of that.
And she, you know, she warns her daughter. She warns her of what she might think of her, the mother. And the other thing that's so interesting is she's right on, and what is so well drawn out is she's right on, she's always living right on the edge, you know?
The mother.
Yeah.
Yes.
She's right on. And then you take her dad, who I liked. I mean, I liked him. He had his weaknesses, but he seemed like a very nice person to me, or tried to be a very nice person.
I think he is a nice person, and in writing the book, that was what surprised me, because I was so focused on her, Shalini, and her mother, and all of a sudden there was this man who had just been there all along, and whose very constancy was a kind of a form of love.
How come, why'd you make him love music so much, and such American music?
That's a great question. The book is set in over a span of time, but when Shalini is a child, that is primarily in the 90s, and that's when I grew up. And the 90s were a time when India was sort of moving away from the British colonial you know, music and TV shows, and a lot more American shows were appearing on TV, a lot more American music was arriving, that was as interesting to me as anything, because along with that, you had the sort of, in a certain milieu of people, urban, upper middle class, or you had more nuclear families. You had people moving away to the city, getting a job, getting married, having a child or two children, and the grandparents and the aunts living in some other city or in you know, in the ancestral home. And I wanted this family to be modern in that way. You know, this is not certainly not applicable to across India, but there was a small cross section of Indian society that was experiencing this kind of shift, and I wanted them to be part of it. And so the father goes to Colombia, and he has this fetish for all things American.
So one thing that really bothered me about it, and without trying to, this is not meant to be a spoiler, but why does he have a relationship with the colonel that allows him to recommend his services to his daughter? This is just a question for me, not for anyone who's listening.
How does he know the colonel?
Yeah.
Good question. I think I had it in mind that they had gone to college together at some point.
That makes sense. Okay.
Yeah, or they had been in high school together. I can't remember. I can't even remember if I put that on the page or explained it, but they have an association that goes back to their youth.
So how does, switching gears, how does Bashir, with his wit and his charm and his stories, hide the fact from the world and, more importantly, hide the fact from himself, much like his son does, of who he really is? Or how does anyone, really?
How does Bashir hide who he really is from himself?
Yeah.
I think it's the easiest thing in the world to hide what you are from yourself.
Me too.
I think they all do. I think they all hide it from themselves. And they get glimpses of it. And that's partly where the sort of crisis comes from, where they're brought face to face with what they are and what they're not. And they react, each of the characters reacts very differently to it. It seems such a universal experience to be unable to evade the very fact of your character.
Well, that's true of Shalini. It's true of Bashir. It's true of Bashir's son. It's true of many characters in the book. But at the same time, if you take someone like Zoya and Abdul, they seem to be more like my daughter, integrated. They are who they are.
Right.
And
they're the lucky ones.
Well, they're lucky and unlucky. I mean, do you think, like many people in America who have lost somebody, or in South America where there's the disappeared ones, do you think they hold out hope, or do you think they just do what they have to do to continue on?
I think that's a good question. I think they're different in the degree of hope they hold and the reason that they're doing what they're doing. I think Zoya does believe, or makes herself believe, and in that she's not so different from Bashir Ahmed or anybody else who she has this idea and she holds on to it in the face of evidence to the contrary, or statistics or what have you. And Abdul Latif, I think I'm very fond of him. I think he's a kind person, and I think the reason that he is doing a lot of it is for his wife. And what he believes or does not believe, he doesn't consider as important as what she needs.
And he also has a very nice smile.
He has a very nice smile. That's true.
Do you think, like, as some reviewers have noted, well, I don't necessarily agree. I mean, I liked Shalini. I liked her as a person. But do you think that she's ignorant and unable to be honest with herself, which is what I got from Kirkus or one of the reviews?
Let me think about that. She is like many people I know, Shalini.
Uh-huh.
In that, and I'm talking about people I know in the United States, people I have met, people I know from India, people all over the world. There's no nationality that this applies to more than any other. People who are very smart, who are educated, who have traveled, who seem to have wide view of the world, and yet there's something sort of naive about them. You know, they don't seem really to have seen the places that they've gone to, or to have really considered the facts of their own position in, a particular society, or the ramifications of that position. And so she's not ignorant per se, she just does not think too much about those issues. And she sees the world in a very inward way. And it has to do with her mother, and it has, her world is her mother, her father, herself. And then when she meets the people that she meets, her world is those people. And she is incapable of sort of stepping back and seeing the whole picture for what it is. And sure, that is a kind of naivete. But I don't think it's a very uncommon form of naivete, nor do I condemn her for it.
No.
I think it's quite common. And when I was writing the book, I was thinking of all of these stories that are quite popular, I think. There's certainly a market for them, of young people, young women often, who decide that they're going to go off and find themselves. And they often go to a country that's not theirs or a place that's not theirs, and then they're there. And the people who live in those places play supporting roles in their lives. And then they come home with a sort of changed perspective and some photographs, and they sort of feel affirmed in their own sense of worth. And when I was writing this book, I wanted to write that story, but I wanted to turn it upside down. So she does all of those things, but she does not come back with a heightened sense of self-worth. I do think she comes back with a greater sense of the outline of her character, which I think in some ways is a more valuable goal, to find out exactly what you are and what you're not.
I think that is too. I remember reading Hermann Hesse's Journey to the East, and when he's confronted with different tasks that are harder and harder, the first one was to face your own personality, and he didn't want to do that. No, yeah, and the second one was like being tortured by a dog, being bitten, you know, and the guy says, you know, each one of these is going to get harder.
Yeah, so, labors of Hercules.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, too, because it goes back to what I was saying about leaving a lot of this up to the reader. So I got the arc in, and I own a bookstore, so I got the arc in, and I look for it, and it's missing. And one of my employees took it home, and I said, why are you taking it home? I have to read this for my interview. And she does this all the time, and it drives me crazy. And I said, look, it has papers inside with, you know, her interview and all that stuff. If you see that, get an idea that I'm going to be interviewing her. So anyway, this is probably, it will be, because she's the head of it, and everybody's wants to read this book. So it's going to be a book club selection, and I can just see across the table each of them arguing about whether Shalini is a good person or a bad person. And I
well, that's great to hear.
Well, have you gone out on the road yet with this? I mean, have people asked you questions?
I have not gone out on the road. This is the first time I've ever been asked questions about this novel.
You picked the wrong person.
No, I think I did exactly the right thing.
So when you went to Kashmir, did you find that you had some of this ignorance, that you weren't quite in tune with what was going on? Or did you feel like when you went there, did you feel like, oh, yes, I'm kind of home, or I understand this, or I understand what's going on here? Did you share some of her, you know, what you were talking about? Did you share some of her ignorance?
Yes. I think that's quite easy to say. Yes, I did. Not in the same ways. I was different from her in that I had read a lot about Kashmir before I went there, and she deliberately does not. And I had been thinking about this novel even before I went. So I was approaching the place from a very different perspective. But even so, there were things about it that I could not have expected. You know, the people I met, the stories they told, I was continually surprised. And each time I thought I had got the handle of it, you know, something would happen that would completely surprise me.
You know, it's funny because there were other kinds of stories in my head from this book, like the one I just talked about with Hermann Hesse. The Bashir's son and, well, first of all, his wife is like the nicest character in the book, and she's so sweet, and she laughs all the time, and she loves Shalini, and yet the relationship between, without spoiling things, the relationship between her and Bashir's son almost seems to me to be like the King Arthur story and Guinevere and Lancelot.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It's like, they're not that they both aren't noble, they are in a way, but then things happen. And
they're noble at cross purposes.
Yes. Yes.
Yes. Yes, I think that's a very apt description of their relationship. I'm very fond of those characters, particularly Amina. She's as close to, since we've been talking about good and bad,
right.
She's as close to being a more uncomplicatedly good character than any of the others, or like your daughter, more integrated.
Yeah, you only meet like half a dozen people in your life that are just what they are. They don't resonate. They don't ring like a bell.
Mm-hmm.
They just are who they are, and they're not going to change for other people. They just are who they are, and generally, they're good.
Yeah, and I think it's a much harder it's a much harder quality to cultivate than the self-help books would have us believe.
Oh yeah, but then it's harder and it's easier because if you're born like a Buddha baby, and and you just continue in that way, then it's actually the easiest thing. But
yeah.
But it's really hard to be like that.
Yeah, I agree.
So. If we go on to the kernel, and again, I got to be very careful what I say. Here's where she, I think, assuming she's reliable, which is always an assumption that, you know, maybe you think, maybe you believe that she's totally reliable, but I think it's up to the reader to determine that. But as with the kernel, she thinks a particular thing, which is why she says what she says. She has no idea that she's such a nitwit. Right.
She has no idea she's a nitwit?
Yeah, by asking him to take care of it.
Right.
Especially what
yes,
she...
I mean, she certainly has a reason for saying to him the things she says to him. But, well, I suppose it's up to the reader to, like you said, to decide whether or not those reasons were... Those reasons were good enough, and again, you know, I think she's approaching the world from a fairly self-focused place, and she is thinking of the way she feels and the what she can do, rather than what ought to be done. And yeah, it's a matter for debate, I think.
Why'd you make her a swimmer?
Good question. I don't know for certain why I made her a swimmer or an athlete of any kind. I think I wanted to give her something, especially growing up, you know, something that was purely pleasurable and that could submerge her. That was the antithesis of the family that she grew up in. I think I wanted to give her some relief.
Yeah, and I think it gives her parents relief too, and it gives them something to root for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true that the times that they seem most cohesive as a parental unit has to do with her swimming.
When you wrote not that they're that much alike, but I was looking at your story, Lori Raja, and I was wondering, so how much earlier was that written than this book?
I wrote that story, I believe, in 2011. I began writing this book in 2013.
Oh, okay. Because there's certain aspects of it that are... Oh, well, that reminds me. You talked about in one of your interviews about the idea that, you know, when... And there are so many of them now, books about India.
Mm-hmm.
People in America look at it like India is just this one whole thing, as if Africa is one country.
Right, exactly.
And where American novels, you know exactly where you are and you know the traits.
Absolutely.
So
yeah, that was very important to me to do.
To separate, to show that Kashmir and the Hind, to show that.
Yes, yes, hugely important. I mean, I grew up in Bangalore. I had little to no idea. I wasn't thinking about Kashmir. I wasn't thinking about West Bengal. I wasn't thinking about Chhattisgarh, or I wasn't even thinking about Delhi. You know, the speech patterns are different, the languages are different, the foods are different, and when I read a review that says I learned so much about Indian culture, I in some way think that, well, I failed. You know, the whole point is to sort of destroy that notion of Indian culture, because it isn't just one thing.
It's good that you mentioned food so much, because I think that's a good entree, no pun intended, into the idea of what a country is about. I like when that happens, but I don't know how you can it's like when Americans go abroad and they don't know the language. And so what they do is they ask something and then the person doesn't understand, so they just say it a lot louder, thinking that that person should understand English and should understand it if you speak louder.
Right.
How do you think that America, especially given the times we're in, how do you think that America could ever begin to separate the cultures and the peoples and the cities and regions of another country, especially India?
I don't think it's that hard. I mean, Indians have been separating the culture of America for a long time, and it comes through books and it comes through, you know, movies and all of that. And I think curiosity is the first step, and going into anything you read or anything you watch with few preconceptions, and meeting the people you happen to meet with as few preconceptions as you can, asking a lot of questions. I truly don't think that it's beyond the reach of anyone, and certainly not beyond the reach of Americans.
Hey, speaking of countries and states and stuff like that, when I dialed your number, it's a 208 area code, which is Boise, Idaho.
Yes.
Why are you... Are you in Boise, Idaho?
I am in Boise, Idaho.
Of all the...
I'm outside of Boise.
But in all the places you could be... be in America, why are you in Boise, Idaho?
My husband's family lives here. We're here for the holidays. It is a beautiful place.
I've never been there. It's like, you know, I live in Philadelphia, and I didn't see the Liberty Bell till I was 30.
I still haven't. Maybe this time. But, well, you're 30 years old, and that is nothing, so.
That's true. I hadn't seen that, and I hadn't seen City Hall and William Penn and all of those things. What's there to see in Boise?
You know, I've never actually been to Boise because I'm outside of Boise.
Outside,
I'm
right.
Closer to Ketchum.
Okay, so Ernest Hemingway.
Yes, his grave is just up the road.
Everyone in his family committed suicide.
I think a lot of people did. I've been inside his house. It is a very peculiar and intense experience.
Who are your inspirations, both Indian and American?
Writers?
Yeah.
I always forget the names of all writers and books when I am asked this question. It's like I've never read anything in my life. But I love J.M. Coetzee. I love Anita Desai. I really like Zadie Smith's essays. I love Alice Munro. And I love all these writers for different reasons. James Baldwin. Giovanni's Room was a book I was thinking about a lot. Elsa Morante. I loved her novel History. Many others.
Yeah, actually, some of your... Well, not the essays of Zadie Smith, but some of her novels, like White Teeth and all. I don't know why, but they kind of have... They resonate with me as if you took some inspiration from them. I don't mean it in a bad way. I mean, it just seems like they're very similar in terms of tone. Maybe not, but just...
Well, I mean, that makes sense. I really loved White Teeth. She's writing about a multicultural, multilingual world that is very much to do with class and all of that, and so am I in a very different context. So I think I'm influenced by pretty much everything I read, whether it's a shampoo bottle or, you know, Hemingway. So there's no question. I'm sure that White Teeth crept in there somewhere.
Yeah, I'm influenced by cereal boxes.
Those are good ones.
I always read the back of them while I'm eating. There's something there.
I agree.
Even the ingredients. What was I going to ask you? What do you think... Where do you think you'll go from here? Because it's amazing. Like Anthony Mara, who I interviewed, and a bunch of the other people who blurbed the book, all these people are saying all these wonderful things. I mean, And I know you will go on tour, and I know this book, just from the buzz around the bookstore and nationwide, is going to do really, really well. Is this all like a big shock to you?
A huge shock. A huge shock. I sold the book almost 3 years ago, and it was quiet. I'm with Grove, who are just an extraordinary publisher. I think they do their jobs like artists themselves, I told myself that I would be just happy the book came out, and so all of this has been very unexpected and makes me very nervous.
Yeah, and also, if you want to get nervous, the fact that this book is very cinematic is when you get optioned by Steven Spielberg or something like that.
That would be great. Do you know him? Could you give him a call?
I met him one time, but the only reason I met him was because he was in Starbucks ahead of me, and I saw his cup said SS. And
oh, that's funny. Well, next time you see him, just
I'll put him in a good word. I'm sure that will help a great deal. Well, it was a pleasure talking to you and learning more about the book. And as I said, I own a bookstore, and we'll be on our front shelf and in the window. And as I said, it's already going to be picked as a book club book. Maybe you can Skype in and talk to the book club. That would be great.
I would love to. Thank you for doing all of this for the book. And I can't wait to come visit the shop someday. Lots of people have told me wonderful things about it.
Oh, that's great.
I would love to visit.
Thanks very much. And thanks for being here. We were talking with Madhuri Vijay, author of The Far Field. I can honestly say this is going to be one of the best books of 2019, and it already has so much buzz. It'll be in our bookstore. It'll be picked as a book club. And as you just heard, maybe she'll come and Skype in and visit the store. And I'm glad she heard wonderful things, but I have no idea who would have told her those things. But in any event, another great artist that Rebecca has picked, and we have a whole bunch of good people coming up, and it's the new year, so we haven't lined up everybody yet, but next time we talk, I'll have a pretty good idea of who we can expect in the coming weeks and months. So as always, and this was great, I really enjoyed this conversation. As always, thanks so much for joining us, and we hope you'll join us next week here on The Avid Reader.